Ready to take a deeper look at where history, politics, and economics all intersect? Well, then you've come to the right place. Each week, here's where we pull back the headlines and focus on the big trends, the stuff that actually shapes our future. Through the noise, we focus on the signal. I'm your host, Neil Howe, and this is Demography Unplugged. Today is June 2nd, 2020, and this is Demography Unplugged. Welcome back, everybody. As we did last week and actually several weeks now, I have on my podcast my fellow analyst, Christian Ford, up in downstate Maine or upstate Maine. I'm not sure which way you say it, Christian.
Yeah. Well, I'm in northern Maine right now, but some people call it down east.
Down east. Okay. And I understand you're going to have a special visitor soon.
Right. Trump is planning a visit to the state of Maine, and the Maine Governor Janet Mills has asked him not to come because she's afraid it will create unrest. And to those comments, he said he is now definitely coming.
That's Trump always knowing how to soothe the passions of America. And I'm sure he's going to be very welcome. From what I know of northern Maine, I'm sure Trump will have a good time there. As always, if you want to dive deeper into everything we talk about on this podcast, please consider subscribing to our research product, Demography Unplugged, which I put together with my team at Hedgeye Risk Management. You can Google it and find out how you get on. Among other things, you'll be able to get our newswire, watch my weekly show on COVID-19. We have special interviews with guests, and in fact, Christian, this might be not good to mention that next week I'll be interviewing Howard Penny, who's director of Hedgeye's restaurant sector. So we're going to be talking about the future of eating out, or indeed, if eating out has a future. that is a dark subject now, what's happening to restaurants. So we're going to get into that. We're going to have charts. It's going to be, anyway, I'm looking forward to that. We have on this show a hopelessly ambitious agenda. We're going to do our usual. We're going to cover markets, economic indicators. I will talk about the George Floyd incident and the riots. I've been asked often about it already. We're going to move on to another big subject, which is Hong Kong. The new security law, which has just been passed by, or I should say rubber stamped by the equivalent of China's national parliament, which meets once a year, and the decertification of Hong Kong's autonomy by United States Secretary of State Pompeo. But I think that's a sleeper. I think that is a much bigger issue than most people realize, because I don't see many ways for either side to back down on this. I think the dynamics around that are dangerous. We're going to talk about that, particularly given changes in U.S. attitudes toward China. I want to say a few things about Brexit negotiations on trade. In June, negotiations between U.K. and EU were supposed to reach a kind of a turning point. They're going to have a little bit of a summit and decide on whether they can get everything done by the end of the year, which I don't think anyone thinks they can. So that's an interesting cliffhanger. The big EU fiscal deal and what that means for the future of the EU. And then if we get to it, so many other subjects. The free fall of Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil. The pandemic is rampant. I don't know what its R naught is, but it's probably up around 2. Jair Bolsonaro is being, he's being abandoned by most of his key cabinet members. And everyone's, all foreign investors are extracting their money. That's one emerging market that's not doing better this month than last month. Matteo Salvini in Italy is on trial. So what's the future of right-wing populism in Italy? All that and more. My gosh. So let's just jump right in. Christian, markets. What did the S&P do?
All right, so since our last podcast, over the last 9 trading days, the S&P 500 is up 3.4%, and the global Dow is up 4.9%. And for volatility, the VIX closed yesterday at 28.23. And on our last podcast, it was in that same area, at around high 20s, 29.
Interesting. So for the first time in many, many, many weeks, the rest of the world has actually outgained the S&P. Which, you know, has to be satisfying right. to a lot of people to bring a little bit more balance into the world. And the VIX still in the upper 20s. Still spooked a little bit. And so we might as well move on and we can talk a little bit about economic indicators. I don't know, we could start with the U.S. and move on.
All right, well, starting in the U.S., we recently got the Chicago Fed National Activity Index for April. Now, this came in at -16.74. This is a record contraction. And now, the Fed has always said in the past, Neil, that if you take the 3-month average of this index and it's below -0.7, this equals a recession. Well, the 3-month moving average is now -7.22.
Well,
now you've often said that, you know, during economic downturns, it can be difficult and we debate whether we're in an actual recession, but I think it's pretty clear during this that we are in a recession.
Yeah, I don't think anyone's really parsing that number right now. This is the only recession in my lifetime I can remember where there is no question about it. So that might have been an interesting indicator and a filter at any other time. So what else has been going on?
Well, we also got some market PMI flashes for May. Services came in at 36.9. Now, total sales fell at the second fastest rate in the series history. The first fastest was last month.
Yeah.
For composite, it came in at 36.4 for May. Also, the second fastest decline in activity, with the first being April.
There you go.
But, you know, numbers still not great there. We also got the market manufacturing PMI final for May. That came at 39.8, and that matched the flash data.
Right. What else you got?
Well, that's mostly what we have for the U.S. that's big. If we go on to China, we got the NBS manufacturing PMI, which came in at 50.6 for May. And this really isn't a great number. We've been talking about this, Neil, that it's been around this flat 50 for about 3 or 4 months now.
Right, right. That's mainly, it got this huge contraction in February, early March, and it's just been steady, right? The problem now is no longer that people can't go to work. It's not even so much that Chinese consumers can't consume, although that still remains very depressed. The big problem now is that they can't export to anyone. So,
<Right.
laughs> you know, this is how supply shocks and demand shocks feed on each other in a vicious cycle.
Right. Well, if we go on to Europe, a bunch of PMIs came in. They were mostly in the mid-30s to early 40s. A little interesting side note is in Italy, we got the business confidence indicator, and this had stopped running because the coronavirus was so bad that they couldn't put out the survey. But we finally got it for May, and it was 71.2, and now this is its lowest reading in its history. Now, we've always known it was bad there, but now we're finally getting those indicators back and running.
Right. Wow. And where else have you got? Is that it?
We have some other data coming out of Japan. We got some PMI flashes. The manufacturing is at 38.4 for May. You know, this is its steepest contraction since March. Services in Japan, 25.3 for May.
Wow.
Second lowest reading since
25.3. And Japan is Japan mobility actually hasn't declined that much. I mean, Japan is the miracle case of the one country where COVID has been limited and actually there hasn't been much of a shutdown. At least there was a little bit in Tokyo last month. That is, right. We already knew, right? Japan is the one economy that is certifiably in recession because they went in recession, you know, they went negative GDP in Q4 last year. So they're kind of a little bit ahead of the downturn of everybody else.
Yeah,
they had a head start. But that is that's amazing. 25. Wow. Well, okay. So tell me, is that enough bad news from around the world, or you got more?
Well, we can, if we look to South Korea, you know, they've kind of been one of the success stories, but their consumer confidence came in for May, and that's still at only 77.6. In perspective, in January, it was at 104.3.
Right.
So even with being able to successfully deal with the virus, their economy is still not, people aren't confident that it's at the place that it was.
No, that's correct. But they have dealt with the virus successfully, and also their current government has just received enormous support in the recent election. So in a way, they're right. In a good place. And, you know, now they all dislike Japan again. So that's another thing that unites them.
Yeah.
But I would say that Korea is the epitome of an export nation, right? So that's where they're getting hurt.
Right.
I mean, just think of, you know, Samsung. I mean, just think of all those companies, all those, you know, chai bowls. They're just getting smashed by this. So we'll see how that plays out. Well, if we're through with the indicators from around the world, maybe we can. Is it a good time to go into our bigger topics?
Sounds good to me. Enough bad news economic to bad news political.
Well, bad news political, but interesting news. So I want to talk a little bit about the George Floyd riots and their recent spread across the United States and sort of the different, I've just been asked this a lot, so I felt I really had to respond. There are so many ways, Christian, to look at this. I mean, you know, first of all, the act itself, it seems to all observers unjustified, improper, indeed criminal. And the police officer, Derek Chauvin, has been charged with at least some degree of homicide. And most police chiefs around the world agreed on this judgment, although we have to, you know, watch all the videos and, you know, go through due process. So I guess you could say, does our system work? Certainly the advent of video cams everywhere and people with phones with videos everywhere certainly changed the atmosphere in which police today work. On the other hand, I think it's fair to say that I think all Americans would agree police work is a dangerous and sometimes violent job that few of us would want to do ourselves. It's a violent world out there. And when, you know, dangerous and crazy people are doing things, they're expected to run forward and protect everyone while everyone else can run the other way, right? And that's a very difficult role to be in. A violent world out there. There are hundreds of thousands of violent crimes each year, 15,000 murders each year. The police kill 500 to 600 civilians each year. Some of them, many of them, rule justifiable homicides. Some of them are accidental and for other reasons. Somewhere between 100 to 200 police officers are killed by civilians each year. So, just to put this in perspective, right? I think we would all agree this is a difficult job. On the riots, you can interpret them one of two ways: frustration with unemployment and lack of national leadership. I think that's palpable out there. And the other is, I suppose you could say, a lot of people getting paid a lot not to work. Stay home. They have a lot of time on their hands. I think that's part of it too. And that actually has led to another thing, which I suppose I'm going to have to talk about on Thursday, which is, Will all of the demonstrations and all these people going out into the streets and locking arms and so on, is that going to cause super spreader events? Is that going to actually inflame the pandemic? What are your thoughts on that, Christian?
I am very worried about that. You know, you do see in the videos and the photos, most people are wearing masks, but they're right next to each other. They're shoulder to shoulder. I have a friend in New York City, and he said in the last couple weeks, you know, most people wear masks, but he's noticed less and less of them. And I just don't know how you can have these large gatherings and people not get sick. We're still in a pandemic.
Well, that's true. And, you know, masks serve many purposes, you know, with pepper spray and tear gas. Right. It's also good to wear a mask. Let me just pose, though, three bigger perspectives. Some of these a little bit more historical and generational. And I think that is what I find interesting and significant about them. And the first point I would like to make is this, and I think that's sometimes lost when we, you know, look at stores burning down and people doing looting. And the first is that violent crime has actually been trending down dramatically in America for the last 25 years. And in fact, I often tell people this, you know, the coming of age of millennials into young adulthood has coincided with probably the most dramatic decline in youth violence in American history. Of course, we don't have many figures going back, you know, more than about 40 or 50 years ago, but I just, it would be hard to argue that there'd be another period like this. Millennials don't commit as much crime. They're not as violent. I mean, the fact is very simple. And this is why cities are so much safer, which is why so many millennials are moving into them. And so that's a virtuous cycle, right? They don't commit as much crime. They're not ripping each other off somewhere. So more millennials can actually live safely in them. I lived in New York City in the 1980s, and believe me, that was a very, very different place. Even more, this is happening during the pandemic. Violent crime, by all indications, are declining to absolute record lows. Most young men who commit most crimes are off the streets. And most violence are crimes of opportunity. And we all know what happens when, you know, young guys are out there, you know, right? I mean, we all know that's kind of where violence happens. The murder rate in 2020 will probably go below its earlier low in 2014 and put us back to the mid-1950s. I mean, think about that. This wow. is one of our lowest violent periods in American history. You know, we always think about that, the high tide of the American high, the silent generation coming of age. You know, the worst complaints about school kids was, you know, gum chewing and breaking in line. But just a very different era. Now, here's what I find interesting. There is an historical pattern. The public becomes more lenient and humane about criminal enforcement with about a 20-year lag. And you can see this constantly through American history, particularly recent history. There was a huge decline in criminality and violence in the 1940s and 1950s, which led to what? The Miranda ruling, the Warren Court, much greater leniency in the 1960s and 70s. A lot more talk about, you know, rehabilitation and getting people out of jail and giving criminals much more due process. And then what? We went into the period of, you know, Dirty Harry, the 1970s, 1980s, 90s, a huge crime wave that was spearheaded by boomer youth and to some extent also by Xer youth. And that lasted till about the mid-1990s. What did that result in? Enormous, huge, three strikes, you're out, throw them in jail until they die movement, right? And that was big back in the 1990s. Donald Trump himself was very vocal during that period, as were prominent Democrats like Joe Biden, Kamala Harris, who are now pilloried for the hard line on crime they took, you know, 15 or 20 years ago, back when absolutely everyone supported it, right? Both Republican and Democrat.
Right.
So here's my take on it. This whole you know, cut 50 movement and, you know, let people out of jail who are, you know, committed nonviolent crimes and all that is the almost the predictable consequence of this era. We've seen it again and again. And as I've often pointed out, actually looking at the statistics on the age composition of people in prison, Americans under age 25, which is actually a, you know, very large share of, you know, perpetrators of violent crime, we've actually already cut their number by 50% compared to what it was in the mid-90s. That's how much less crime millennials are committing, right? And prisons are aging, right? So it's all those Xers and boomers which are aging. They're building new wings off of on prisons now to house all these aging boomers who are now getting Alzheimer's and so on. And we're, you know, they're much more expensive to support their health. But we see this huge generational transformation taking place. And I think what that leads to is that we now have much higher standards for acceptable violence by law enforcement. No one would have wanted or expected these higher standards back in the mid-1990s. Today, they do. And I think that's a product of the fact that we have a much more less violent society today, thanks to millennials. And by the way, this also goes for what we find shocking in riots. I mean, people are shocked by the violence they see. And to me, that's a sign we have much higher standards for what constitutes violence. I mean, I am old enough to remember the long, hot summer of 1967 and the burning down of entire parts of cities in, you know, Watts in Detroit. The Rodney King riots of the early 1990s, 63 dead, thousands injured, 4,000 buildings burned down, an estimated $1 billion worth of property damage. I mean, come on now. We're nowhere close to that today. And I just think that we have higher sensibilities. I think that's a good thing for America, right? We have higher standards for how we should behave, higher standards for, you know, how people should behave in demonstrations. And I would say that most of the demonstrations have been actually very peaceful. By all accounts, looting is done by a minority of people, probably of all ages, who find opportunity in these situations. A second observation. The big political impact won't be the deaths, as tragic as they are. It will be over the demonstrations, the violence in the demonstrations, to the extent it happens, and the rioting and the looting. Whatever the provocation or justification, I think it's fair to say most Americans strongly disapprove of lawlessness. And as undeserving as Trump may be help, I think this does help him. I just think that's the fact of it. I think Trump is standing up for authority. You know, the police baton, when the looting starts, the shooting starts, whatever it is, he's standing up for symbols and people of authority. And I think this actually puts a real burden on Joe Biden and Democratic leaders. I've seen it before. I think it's particularly an issue right now. A very interesting insight on this is something I recall from the campaign, presidential campaign by Bill Clinton in 1992. And this was an event that took place with an interview with a rapper back then, a rapper, Sister Soulja. This is before your time, Christian. So I'm not going to expect you to know this. But Sister Soulja was a rapper back then. This is back when you had, you know, gangster rap was really popular. It was a rapper associated with Public Enemy. And it was right around the time, actually, the Rodney King riots. And Sister Soulja, I can't remember. I think she was interviewed and she said something like, if black people kill black people every day, why not have a week and kill white people? Well, that's kind of an interesting policy recommendation. And a lot of, a lot of progressives on the left were very sympathetic and so on. And Bill Clinton came out and strongly repudiated her. And this has come down to be called a Sister Soulja moment. And it was hugely popular, right? Bill Clinton rose in the opinion polls. And that really was a major step toward beating George Bush Sr. and reassuring Americans that a Democrat would be okay, right? Here's a Democrat who, if necessary, you know, could stand up and sort of defend, you know, decent middle class values, whatever they are. And here's a real question I have, Christian. Will Joe Biden do the same? Will Democratic leaders do the same? And I do think this whole issue of authority now is kind of a one-upsmanship. I mean, Trump is saying he's going to send in National Guard, even if governors don't want it. He's going to invoke an 1807 law, which, you know, and there's nothing in the Constitution that says he can't bring in military, even if he's not asked to. But then you see it even between Andrew Cuomo now and Bill de Blasio. Right, Christian? I mean, he was just interviewed today.
Cuomo said that. Right, he was interviewed today, and he was criticizing de Blasio for all the looting that's been happening in New York City, and he said that he's not planning to do it, but there is a possibility he could displace the mayor, take over his job, and bring in the National Guard.
Wow. That's a great first step for Governor Cuomo in 2020, you know. You know, the Democrats have a backup plan against Trump, right? So there you have it. I think that's important. And I just think third, and maybe my final reflection, just sort of building off the same observation, and that is that this is an episode, these riots and the reaction of each party to them well illustrates the dysfunction, in my opinion, within each political party. And that is, you know, Democrats who believe strongly in a tight national community, right? A powerful national community, you know, top-down national leadership, things like, you know, pandemic lockdown and containment, as well as, you know, taxing people and regulating people and creating a much closer sense of national community. But they don't believe in authority, right? So that creates kind of a conundrum, right? You believe in... You believe in a strong national community, but you don't believe in authority. So, you know, how are you going to ever make that happen? I remember a couple of years ago, the campaign, this is around the time of the, you know, going into the midterms to abolish ICE. And Democrats realized that that was very unpopular and kind of got rid of that. But I think this is their problem, right? Most Americans do not want to abolish any enforcement of immigration laws, right? But that's the problem with Democrats. They're sort of associated with this abolish ICE position. And then you have Trump Republicans who kind of have the opposite problem. They believe in authority, but not in national community, which is also sort of a conundrum when you think about it. I mean, you know, Trump is standing up for all the guys who say that, you know, the first thing you learn in life is you always respect an authority figure. You know, you do what a policeman tells you to. And they draw from that. On the other hand, there's no vision there of what that authority is used for, right? What do you use authority for if not to create a community? And in my opinion, and this kind of brings it around to, you know, the fourth turning and what we see generations doing together, and that is the fourth turning will attain regeneracy only when one party can put these two elements together. So, you know, either the Democrats have to, you know, become comfortable with authority somehow, or Republicans will have to become comfortable with community somehow. And I actually think it's probably going to be easier for the Democrats. I mean, it's if you already have some principle of community that you stand for, it's probably easier for you to find authority than it is if you believe in authority, but you have no idea, you know, where you're going with it. And we've seen that before in several crises. We saw that certainly in the Civil War. We saw that in the 30s. But it's going to be fascinating to look at going forward. I think these parties are mirror images of each other in their dysfunction. All right. Well, that took us into the stratosphere. Let's see if I can pull ourselves down to earth here. I want to talk a little bit about China, and we had a Newswire piece, and you know, those who are just on the podcast, not subscribers, again, I urge you, you know, please subscribe. But we had a great piece, I think, on changing American attitudes toward China. And particularly, one survey in particularly we focused on was this new Pew Research Center survey, finding that over the past 2 years, there's been a tidal shift in American attitudes. As recently as 2018, that was just last midterms, 47% of Americans said they had a negative view of China versus 44% who had a favorable view. So slightly negative. And we've seen definitely Americans actually over the last, 10 years becoming decidedly more negative about China. As of March 2020, and this was just as the pandemic was hitting, the negative view has risen to 66% and the positive view has sunk to 25%. Nearly 90% of Americans now say China's power and influence are a threat to the U.S., and 62% say China is a major threat, up from only 48% in 2018. And then, we just go into all kinds of other findings. 40% of Americans say they will not purchase made-in-China products, a much bigger share than from any other country. Most don't think China will follow through on its recent commitment to buy more U.S. goods. Large majority said they would pay more for products at home and that they would favor import restrictions over free trade as a means of boosting the U.S. economy. Nearly 9 in 10 say the U.S. relies too heavily on foreign supply chains. Anyway, we can just go on and on about this. But why this is all interesting is that this is fed into partisan politics. When Trump was first elected back in 2016, he was really the only candidate taking a hard line on China. A lot of the more mainstream Republicans, they were still sort of favored globalism and, working with China. Maybe they'll liberalize in the long run. And obviously Hillary was still divided, although she did turn away from, big global trade agreements during her campaign in 2016. But now the Democrats have totally turned away from globalism, and they're now doing their best to turn the tables on Trump by attacking his eagerness to forgive China's human rights violations so long as he gets his trade deal. Basically, they are turning hardline on China and trying to portray Trump as soft on China. And Joe Biden, as we all know, Trump's presumptive opponent in 2020, is calling Xi Jinping a thug. He's promising to face up to China's militarization in the South China Sea. He's going to actually complete the pivot to China that Obama started. He's basically going to show Trump as a big bully who's, all hot air and no talk. So, and this is at a time, too, when you have bipartisan agreement in Congress and bills basically saying that China needs to be sanctioned. If China takes a hard line on Hong Kong has to be decertified and on and on and on. Well, why is this all coming to a head? Well, you know why it's coming to a head. Last week, China's National People's Congress enacted legislation, or at least announced they were going to enact legislation to impose security laws on Hong Kong, mainland security laws. This basically invalidates or abrogates Hong Kong's independence. Secretary of State Pompeo came out that same week to certify that Hong Kong is no longer autonomous. He refused to certify that Hong Kong is autonomous. And then Trump followed up at the end of last week with measures that will promise to treat Hong Kong as part of mainland China, with no more special status. This will take time through executive orders. But basically, this is going to shut down Hong Kong. Ultimately, there's a little bit of wiggle room there. Maybe he's still trying to negotiate with China, but it seems clear that Hong Kong is to be treated as the rest of China. He proposes delisting Chinese firms from U.S. exchanges. He's threatening to impose sanctions on Chinese entities that violate Hong Kong rights. And Christian, that could lead to sanctions on any companies that supply products that are used in the security of Hong Kong and any banks which lend to those companies. Mm-hmm. This could be like Iran. I mean, this could slam global trade into a wall here. You think China has problems exporting now? It's vitally dependent on the U.S. dollar to fund and finance its foreign trade still. And this threat of a financial war is coming out of nowhere. I think this is underappreciated, and I think it's very difficult at this point, and that's what I think people aren't appreciating. It's very difficult for either side to back down. China is just vowing to go it alone. They say This is too important for us to back down. This is our national integrity and security. It reminds me a lot of Vladimir Putin back when he went into the Crimea and sent his little green men into the Ukraine, right? He basically said, I don't care what the EU and the Americans say about it. This is too important to us. We can never let Ukraine become a member of the EU or become aligned with the West. And I think China's taking the same attitude. It's going to be very difficult, particularly once you see signs of, protesters getting bloodied and people, prominent activists disappearing in China, being hurried away by, security people, back into the mainland. God knows where they're going to end up. We'll never hear from them again. It's going to be very difficult for the West to back down on this, particularly when you've got bipartisan agreement. I mean, just an instance of this is Senator Chris Van Hollen, who's Democrat from Maryland, Senator Pat Toomey, Republican from Pennsylvania, introduced a severe sanctions bill. This is before the passage of this recent legislation. I don't know. I see this as a sleeper. I don't think people are paying enough attention to this, and I think this is something that is going to creep up on us as time goes on.
One thing to watch, Neil, is that 2 days on June 4th is going to be the anniversary in Tiananmen Square. And usually in Hong Kong, they have a vigil, but that has been canceled this year by the Chinese government. But I think protesters are still planning on marching. So it'll be something to watch if that goes wrong and gets out of control.
Be something to watch. But then again, it's you can ban these people in the names of COVID, right? That's an interesting issue. I believe it was only about 8 or 9 months ago that Hong Kong was forbidding people to wear masks. Now they're ordering them to wear masks. I know this is a crazy world, isn't it? It's interesting that the shutdown policies of COVID obviously play into the hands of governments that don't want people to be demonstrating, don't want people to be out there mingling. They go home and they can only communicate with each other on social media. And of course, in a lot of these countries, social media is completely run and censored and monitored by the authoritarians. So, wow, that's just a perfect world for Xi Jinping, right? Yeah, right. There you got it. Well, so what else have we got? I did want to say a few words about the United Kingdom. They've been negotiating trying to negotiate a new trade agreement with the EU. This is going to be a very complex thing. It has to deal with, everything from finance to fisheries and, every kind of subsidies and regulatory rules. And, everyone wants to assure an even playing field, which when you get into such complexity, particularly when you get to services, I mean, it's like you might as well just adopt all the same domestic legislation, which obviously UK doesn't want to do. I mean, that's why the Brexit happened, right? So this is kind of an issue. David Frost, who's been negotiating on the side of the UK, and Michel Barnier, who's on the other side. These negotiations have been going terribly. There's been no progress. There's going to be a summit this month in which they're going to decide, can we make it by the end of the year? Most people don't think they can possibly come to any global agreement by the end of the year. And what's worse is that extension of the deadline actually requires a separate treaty. Because remember, the UK is already out of the EU, so they can't, can't be part of the EU process. And also, Boris Johnson does not want it. So I don't know what's going to happen. Boris Johnson thinks he's in a good bargaining position. He thinks that the EU is down and out right now because of the COVID crisis. He has a majority of 80 in the House of Commons. So he's in a good bargaining position. It's very much harder for the EU to get agreement among all of their, 27 or 28 members. So there you have it. What the UK wants and what they're working toward now is a deal with Canada. Remember, now that the UK is out of the EU, Canada is going to have trouble trading with the EU, with the UK. And Canada actually does do a lot of trading with Britain. So they're trying to negotiate a trade deal now. And what the UK wants is a deal with the EU like Canada has with the EU. So they're trying to get the streamlined deal all set so they can say, look, we've already got this deal with Canada. Canada already has this deal with you. Why don't we just don't do the same deal? One of the issues, of course, one of the differences is that Canada is not a financial powerhouse and Britain is, and finance brings a whole set of new issues there. And one last issue I want to deal with, this whole idea of the level playing field. The biggest problem with these negotiations and trade is that, every country subsidizes some of their own companies, some of their own industries, and, you know, that's a real problem for trade agreements. You don't want the other side, giving, you know, one company or one industry unfair advantage. Now, the EU prevents that within EU members by prohibiting countries from really doing much to subsidize their own companies. And that has now become very interesting because with the pandemic lockdown recession, the EU is basically giving free passes to all of its member countries to subsidize its own companies, right? Everyone's subsidizing their own workers and subsidizing their own big manufacturing companies and so on. So it's kind of creates a very unusual situation where the EU is insisting that no one has an advantage, but it's giving its own countries, you know, free rein to play one-upsmanship with each other. And that kind of brings me into my last thing I want to talk about a little bit, and that is the huge new fiscal measure that was passed last week after an original agreement between Angela Merkel and Emmanuel Macron of a very large recovery plan that's not just lending. It's actually going to be, you know, transfer payments. This is a 750 billion euro recovery plan right away, plus 1.1 trillion euros over the next 7 years. It does need, again, the 27 member approval. And some of the, you know, we talk about the frugal four, right? Norway, Denmark, Austria, and Sweden, they still, you know, disagree. But I think the momentum is in favor of it. And it's amazing how this is being heralded in Europe. This is Europe's moment. Ursula von der Leyen, who's the new EU Commission president, you know, told the press. It's also been called a Hamiltonian movement, a moment. But Hamilton is very interesting because all of the Europeans are hearkening to the magical moment at the founding of the U.S. Republic when, as we who know American history are aware that Alexander Hamilton actually arranged the negotiation in which the Revolutionary War debt would be settled, and all the different colonies, the new states, would actually, pony up and decide to bear all of the burden. Of course, you know, the northern colonies had gone into most of the debt, the northern states, the southern ones not. So the southern has had to be bought off, which is why Washington, D.C., is where it is, not in Philadelphia, not up in New York. So it's an interesting moment here because this is going to be funded the same way. So where's the EU going to get its money? Well, it's going to float massive debt. So all of this debt now, all of the countries are going to go in pro rata. And Germany knows that, of course, it's going to be paying all these money, you know, all this money mainly to the less well-off southern European countries like, you know, Spain and Italy. So I don't know it raises an interesting question, Christian. Are they going to, you know, move the seat of the EU from Brussels and Strasbourg to Berlin? You know, maybe that'll be I don't actually see that happening, but it's interesting. On this issue of subsidies, I want to return to that because Germany is much more prosperous and they have a lot more fiscal resources. Nearly half of the industrial subsidies being spent in Europe now is German government to German companies, right? So isn't that really interesting? Now, Portugal and some of the southern EU countries are screaming, this is unfair, right? Because Germany gets to subsidize its companies during this recession, but these other countries don't have the funds to do the same thing with their own national champions, right? And it also gets back to the whole problem with the negotiations with the United Kingdom, right? Because the EU is saying, oh, we have these very, you know, strict rules for, you know, no one country getting an advantage. But of course, right now, the EU is allowing all of its own members to subsidize their own firms like crazy. So it's a very scrambled situation right now. I will say, though, and this is, in all the questions you can have about it, I've always thought, you know, EU's existence was a tenuous one, particularly come a crisis. I will say that this may be a big win for European integrity. And I say that because the separatist movements and the feelings of animosity within the EU now are quite large and quite passionate. Recently, a poll came out. I thought this was pretty stunning about Italians. First of all, they're just about split on leaving the EU. I don't know, it's like, you know, 43% to 44%, you know, in favor or not in wow. favor. But here's the other thing that really got me. When you ask Italians, who is their best friend? 52% say China, 32% say Russia, and the U.S. is back at 17%. None of them name other European countries. And you ask them who their biggest enemy is, 45% say Germany and 38% say France. Oh, my God. And by the way, the U.S. is also their biggest enemy, down at around 17%, too. So there you see the U.S. and on both lists. But this is and by the way, Luigi Di Maio, who's the leader of the Five Star Movement, we often talk about him. He's the biggest proponent of deals and negotiations with China, opening up their ports and making joint investments together. And he's one of the biggest defenders. The Five Star officials who are now in Brussels are the biggest defender of China before the rest of the EU. I think that this whole this centripetal force is pulling apart the EU. The EU needs something like this. And the reason why Germany went along with shouldering this massive debt, which they know is going to go mainly to other countries, is Germany obviously gains from being in this common market. They get to export all their manufacturing goods and all their great products at a fixed exchange rate to all of these partners, you know, with no tariffs, no regulatory barriers. That's been a huge plus for Germany for many, many years. And it, you know, promises to be a huge plus in the future. They may not have the same opportunities in China and the United States to export in the long run. So this may be existential for Germany. And I think it's certainly changed Angela Merkel's feelings and the feelings of the Bundesbank and so on. All of these defenders of pooling their liabilities with the rest of the European countries or any kind of fiscal union, I think it's beginning to change their minds. We'll see. It may be, frankly, in my opinion, too little or too late. All right. What else have we got? What else are we going to talk about in the waning moments we have left? Did we want to
talk about Brazil?
Brazil. Well, you have what's going on in Brazil? Just give us a quick rundown of that.
Well, you know, we've been talking last podcast that Bolsonaro has been full of political scandals. He has accusations of getting involved with police investigations and. A bigger problem is he's been avoiding COVID, and he basically says it's not a problem. And they are now having massive infection rates. Huge number of cases are coming out. Some estimates say COVID could peak in Brazil between July and September.
Yeah.
That's a long span of time.
Well, it is.
But
it is.
A recent IIF report came out and said that foreign investors are pulling out billions of dollars in Brazil because of these scandals. I think it's $11.8 billion have been taken out of the Brazil stock market between February and May, and $18.7 billion has been pulled out of their bond market between February and April. Now, most emerging markets have actually seen money come back
absolutely.
In since April.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But Brazil's not seeing this trend, and people are worried about the political situation there. There could be even an impeachment trial.
Well, there could be, and Brazil is no stranger to impeachment, since, in fact, I think that's the way both of their former leaders, you know, Lula da Silva and then Dilma Rousseff, well, he'll just join a line of them, right? You know, they were on the left, he'll be on the right. They all seem to exit the same way. Poor Brazil. I do think it's insane what he's doing. He's a little bit more than Trump. He's actually actively trying to sabotage regional governors from enforcing the containment measures. But what's worse for him is not only is his you know, economics minister, finance minister resigned, who was responsible for the one great thing of Bolsonaro's tenure so far, and that is pension reform. Pension reform, I think, is one of the largest long-term obstacles facing Brazil's future. We've talked about it in earlier episodes. Brazil's pension laws were completely crazy. I mean, people are retiring with full benefits in their mid-50s. And, you know, I mean, millions of people. It was completely crazy. Brazil's still relatively young society, but they're aging very rapidly due to their low fertility. So this is absolutely insupportable, right? So he did something actually very brave and very needed with the help of this economics minister. But worst of all, his justice minister resigned, and the justice minister had a huge reputation because he was the guy who headed the the car wash, you know, the basically investigation, the indictments of all the earlier prime ministers who had been found to be taking, bribes and bribes from, you know, Petrobras and all the other, you know, big companies in Brazil. So he's kind of alone now. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if, as his support declines, or at least declines down to the, you know, to the remnant who will never leave him, he could be on his way out. And let's just, you know, not as long as we're on the subject of political scandal, let's just mention very quickly, Matteo Salvini, right? Head of the Lega party. And he's trying to find a way back into politics, but right now, he's gotten himself into a little bit of trouble. I guess we saw this for a while, right? This was an investigation that's been underway for a while.
Right. So if you remember last August, he was still interior minister, and he stopped a migrant rescue boat from landing in Italy. Now, this was very controversial because it seemed it could constitute actual kidnapping because he wasn't allowing them to get off the boat. But as interior minister, he had immunity. And their parliament has to actually vote to see if they can investigate him and bring up charges. And the vote was held last week, and it was in a subcommittee. And 13-7, he was saved. They said there's going to be no investigation. He's going to be able to keep his immunity. Now, technically, this could go further and have a full vote of the full chamber. But that's probably not going to happen. You know, it might make him into a martyr if he actually was put in jail or was charged. So as the time being, it looks like he might have skirted away and dodged the charges.
Well, you know, that would be, yeah, that would definitely be a plus for him. I mean, it'd be a little bit like, you know, what better thing could happen to a Benito Mussolini early in his career than to be thrown in jail? You know, I mean, that right. just feeds the fire. But I think, and particularly over that issue, because that's his signature issue, right? Saying no to immigration. I mean, that's the perfect issue to be thrown in jail over. So I think the Democrats probably aren't all that sad to see that not go forward. And, you know, they have a lot of problems of themselves to deal with coming up, you know, getting their economy back in. I think you know, Salvini, as well as some of these other, you know, Lega supporters, conservatives from Lombardy, some of whom we actually talked about a couple of weeks ago, some of whom who've arrayed themselves very well during the pandemic lockdown, been very successful, are waiting in the wings. All right. The right wing party to take over sort of strong national leadership from the Democrats. And so I'm sure they're seeing that party still right there. they don't dare make too many mistakes. They're right there. Just one vote of no confidence, new election. And the polls show they're very well situated. Well, I think we actually made it from one end of the world to the other. As always, Christian, great to meet up. I hope maybe you'll be able to see our president up in your end of Maine.
I'll keep you updated.
He might just, you know, drive down the road to your little area of the woods there. So I guess it's a good time to sign off. Again, just doing a plug for our sector, Demography Unplugged. Any of you are interested, again, Google us either at hedgeye.com or just Google Demography Unplugged and you'll get on. Thank you all very much. And we'll return next week, same time and same day. Thanks again. Thank you for joining me on this episode of Demography Unplugged. If you like what you've heard and want to dive deeper, I've got some good news for you. I'm offering a special research service for subscribers. It provides unique insights you won't see anywhere else. Deep dive analysis, charts, videos, and much more. It's designed to help professionals and investors uncover hidden trends and critical developments driving world markets and economies. You can learn more about it online at www.hedgeye.com, or you can just Google Demography Unplugged. You can also follow me on Twitter at HowGeneration. That's H-O-W-E Generation.
This content is for informational purposes and does not constitute an offer to sell or buy any investment vehicle, nor does it constitute an investment recommendation or legal, tax, accounting, or investment advice. This information is presented without regard for individual investment preferences or risk parameters and is general, non-tailored, non-specific information. Hedgeye believes the information sources to be reliable but is not responsible for errors, inaccuracies, or omissions. The opinions expressed are those of the individual speaking. All investments entail a certain degree of risk, and financial instrument prices can fluctuate based on several factors, including those not considered in the preparation of the content. Consult your financial professional before investing. The information is protected by copyright laws and is intended solely for the use of its authorized recipient provided access by Hedgeye. Redistribution or republication is strictly prohibited and subject to the terms of service at hedgeye.com.